And Michael and I chose the same chapter, and we thought, how marvelous. So we can explore it from different angles. So as we were all popping in, I was just realizing that's our co-creativity. And as Michael was sharing, we are dedicating tonight to Joanna Macy, who recently passed from this life, a Buddhist teacher, activist, visionary. And I wanted to just start my talk with a quote from one of her early books, World as Lover, World as Self. It's a pretty worn copy, 1991. And she writes, "We don't have to go it alone, and we can't. The strength and wisdom we need is not to be concocted on our own, but found in interaction. For that is how they arise, interdependently." Well, I want to say that I first was drawn to this chapter because of how Suzuki Roshi offers a bridge between Zen and its emphasis on bodhisattva activity with what he calls God's creation, and how this can challenge our ideas of, or perhaps ambivalence, or even outright rejection of, or fascination with, and also possibly our own personal lived experiences of God and creation. And I particularly was curious about this line that he spoke. "But if you think that God created," he said man, we could say humankind, "and that you are somehow separate from God, you're liable to think you have the ability to create something separate, something not given by God." And then he goes on to contrast the small I with the big I and essentially equates the big I with God. And then he asserts that God's creation is the activity of true giving. And then he adds what I think is a very important guidepost. He says, "Then whatever you do is true giving, is dana prajna paramita." Well, dana prajna paramita, of course, is a foundational teaching, practice, expression of the Mahayana, of our bodhisattva way, and many of our teachers have spoken about it. Not only Suzuki Roshi, but I as I read that, I remembered particularly that Suzuki Roshi's student, and as Norman often says, our teacher, Sojin Roshi, Mel Weitzman, he spoke about this many times, dana prajna paramita. And in a talk, particularly that he gave at Tassajara in 2006, and it's transcribed so you can find it online, he said, "This word prajna means wisdom, but not wisdom in the usual sense. It is the wisdom of non-duality." This is interesting. Then he says, "The reconciliation of opposites." This is the important part, he says. How do we practice the wisdom of the reconciliation of opposites, the duality of oneness, and the oneness of duality? This feels very resonant to me, this whole theme of reconciling opposites. It's very up for me during these challenging times. And when I read that, it reminded me of a koan, which is likely familiar to many of us. It's case 14 from the Blue Cliff Record. A monk asked Yunmen, "What are the teachings of a whole lifetime?" Yunmen said, "An appropriate response." True giving, we could say, is an appropriate response. And what makes it appropriate is the reconciling of opposites. And part of why this is really up for me, and maybe for you too, during these challenging times, is that I'm often unsure about how to respond. And it has a lot to do with how to not only reconcile myriad views, all kinds of options, high stakes, really tough stuff going on. But particularly this aspect of where is the resistance? What's the opposition that's going on internally and in relationship? And so I'm really taken with this theme of reconciling opposites. And Sojin often spoke about practice is as our ability to respond. And I love this. The way he said that was our ability to respond is our responsibility. So simple, right? So workable. And another thing he said is that our entry to discerning what is justice is just this. In any given situation, right? So, how do we respond that way? Well, for me, this it connects back to God. And I gotta say, I'm sort of a poll I took informally. You know, this chapter is not necessarily the favorite of many people. And I think it's because, we have a lot going on with that G-O-D. But that said, I find myself more and more. It took a while, but I would say that nowadays I very often am praying, and it comes quite naturally. And when I really look into that, what is that praying really about? I could say a little more about what it looks like, but given the time that we have, I just say the spirit of it is that I'm particularly seeking direction, a way through, a way to respond. And, Norman has talked quite a bit about God and prayer, and he also has said that, he was encouraged and felt very at home. That Suzuki Roshi talked about God. So I was looking around and I found a interchange between him and our dear Sue Moon, kind of in the style of their book, What is Zen, where she's asking him questions and he's responding. And this was for the journal Inquiring Mind in 2021. And you'll love this. It's called God is a Three-Letter Word. So in it, Sue asks Norman, do you pray? If so, to whom? And Norman replies, I pray all the time to God. I'm asking God to help out with this and that, mostly friends who are ill, people who have died, the crazy, messed up, sad, and foolish world. Please help with all of this, God, as I know you will. I am never disappointed with God's active response because I know what to expect. And I am thanking God a lot for almost everything. So here we have now that an appropriate response is an active response. And my own experience of God helping out, at least of late, as I was saying, was lean towards show me the way. And particularly, again, when I kind of look more deeply into about what in particular, it's about the way of reconciliation, from which, again, in my experience, gratitude naturally appears. It's not an add-on. It's just actually naturally what flows. And it therefore is so affirming of how close we can be, what that's really about. But the thing is, we don't really need to look to other religions to encounter this. We have our own, if you will, action stories of encounter in our koans. And there's one featuring the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion. Again, another one pretty well known, might be familiar to you. And one of the things I love about that Bodhisattva is the Bodhisattva is gender fluid, appears as male, female, transmutable, and actually sometimes is called the goddess of compassion. Sometimes is considered a deity as well as a bodhisattva. And what people mean by that in different cultures, of course, is interesting in of itself, a subject for another time. But in this koan, which appears among other places in the Book of Serenity, we hear of this encounter, and I'm just going to share part of that koan, the beginning. Yunyan asked Daowu, "What does the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion do with so many hands and eyes?" Daowu said, "It's just like someone reaching back for a pillow in the middle of the night." You can feel that, right? Now, there's a lot more to that koan, of course, but that quality of responding just like that is what I wanted to bring forth. And it emerges from an attunement, really a resonance. I think that's the word, if I'm not mistaken, that Kathy Fisher shared with us that she really liked in terms of the Nagarjuna's teaching about emptiness of resonance. You can really feel that. And that in doing that, the response is precisely to what is happening and what is needed. And that is our bodhisattva activity. Now, this connects back to what Suzuki Roshi says later in this chapter, which is essentially that when we're sitting in zazen, we don't know who we are. We're just sitting. But when we get up, that's the moment of creation, and that everything is created in that moment. So, of course, that is also Shakyamuni's moment under the Bodhi tree of waking up together with all beings. Yeah. And so, in that way, Suzuki Roshi's telling us that creation is actually our bodhisattva activity of waking up together. And another way to say that, what's hilarious is that as I just said that, my Zoom view went from gallery to speaker. So we were all one. I was looking in the mirror. How marvelous. That was a God moment. Was going to say, another way of saying that is that we practice for the sake of practice. And this naturally also expresses what Sojin was saying is the wisdom of reconciling opposites. Now, in the iconography, I don't know about you, I'm very visual. So I really, like, for instance, appreciate the several tankas that are here in the background, several screens, yeah. But the image of Kuan Yin, of Canon, where there are those thousand arms, right? And in each hand, there's an eye. And there's a whole framework from the Diamond Sutra about the five eyes. But the essence of this is that this eye not only sees that we're not separate, but because of that also knows how to respond, therefore reaching for the pillow in the middle of the night, or maybe you need a breath mint or a cup of tea or an embrace, whatever it might be. Maybe you really oughtn't do that. That's not going to be good. Sometimes we need that too. So, whatever's needed. And in that way, I don't necessarily, when I say I'm praying, right, that can also be, chanting the Heart Sutra and getting to the line, which is also, right, Avalokiteshvara, that energy of wisdom and compassion that the Bodhisattva with nothing to attain depends on or relies on, Prajnaparamita, bong. That's when the bell sounds. That's a moment of, if you will, seeing this goddess, this Bodhisattva, which is none other than ourselves, as a guide. And in that way, it's like when Suzuki Roshi is talking about, be careful, because if we see her as separate, you look at that statue, if you see her as separate, if you feel those arms as somehow separate, so when we're chanting, right, our liturgy, when we're chanting the Heart Sutra, she appears, he appears, they appear as we, as you and I, as these very eyes, these voices, our very being activated through that wisdom and activating our compassion. And then as I was writing this, I was waxing a little poetically, so I'll just share it with you. Her eye is the eye of God, goddess, the eye that is big eye, bodhisattva eye. This warm-hearted awareness that recognizes what we are doing is continually transforming, waking up together, awakening compassion for and with everyone. Canon responding is our creativity being God's, or we might say one with God's creation, and that is our wholehearted activity. So that all sounds great, and I wanted to share a personal experience that happened quite recently that I think really speaks to the heart of this. It's a story of reconciliation and peace, and it emerged recently in my role as a hospice chaplain. So I got a call, and I was asked to visit a man in his early 80s. His family had requested this after seeing him on several occasions, where he was, at this point, he's lying in a hospital bed all the time. And one day he started to just weep and then apologize to hired caregivers who are first generation immigrants from Southeast Asia. And he did this a number of times, so as family members were noticing. And as I was talking to one of them, they explained that during the Vietnam War, he had worked for some branch of the US government. And they said he was an assassin. And throughout his life, he had had many moments of regret. And they thought that this was coming up very strongly now. So I went to visit him. First visit, I approached him and I said, "Are you at peace?" And he said, "I'm on a journey to peace." And he had a bunch of photos of his family, big smiles, multi-generational celebratory occasions looked like in those photos. And so we talked about his family and all that. And that was the first visit. Second visit, I say to him, "I hear you have regrets." And he says, "I have regrets." Say a little more. He says, "I killed evil people who killed many innocent people, and they would have killed many more." So I'm taking that in. But I'm not really sure what's going on for him as regret. and I don't want to assume. So I drop what I call a pebble in a pond. And I say to him, yeah, everyone was a baby once. Now he had been sort of gazing down, but at that moment he looks up, he looks me in the eye, and he says, very firm tone of voice, they were evil. I killed evil people who killed many innocent people, and they would have killed more. So what he had just said, but now very firmly, very clearly. And I realized he had set up this dichotomy of evil and innocent, and that's where he was at. So I took a breath and I said, then what is it? What's weighing on your heart? And he said, after a few moments, well, they had families. And I said, yeah, families that love them. And he said, yes. We sat there. And then I said, the family was here now, if that was possible, what would you say to them? Paused. And then, in a very different tone of voice, again, he looked me in the eye and he said, I'm sorry. And when he said that, I could really feel it. And I not only felt it in this body, but I really felt that rippling out, as we say, in space and time, mysteriously, inconceivably, but very palpably. That his turning was having some kind of reconciling going on that was activating a peace. And what was remarkable about that, for me particularly, was that, I had to let go of, if you will, where I might have been when I first entered that room. Maybe what my hope or wish for him or for the world is that we could have had more of a conversation more aligned with Thich Nhat Hanh's wonderful poem, Call Me by My True Names, or Thich Nhat Hanh's famous words, man is not the enemy. That we could have talked about, yeah, everyone was a baby once. What do we mean by evil and innocent? How do we live in a world where, again, as Thich Nhat Hanh said, you're just the tip of the flame? We're all responsible. And so on. But that wasn't where he was at. And yet, imperfectly, his I'm sorry rippled and was healing. And to me, that is a very deep, bringing forth of this whole chapter of Dana Prajnaparamita. And then on the third visit, which quite amazingly, folks, was last night, late yesterday afternoon, towards the end of my work day, I got a call from the triage nurse from this person's daughter. Who was in his room and he was actively dying, as we say. It's a term, strange as it is, could be any time. And they wanted the chaplain to come right away. So I did. And there were quite a number of family there, all ages. They were a little bit distant from the bed, as sometimes happens, from being close to him. I invited them to come closer and eventually holding hands. And he's in and out, but he is able to affirm that he is at peace. And so we're affirming the family's love, and it's quite beautiful. And then he starts saying over and over again, and he has not mentioned religion once in any of our meetings. He starts saying, "Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord." And I turn and I look to his daughter, and she whispers to me, "I'm not religious, but he is." And I say, "It'd be okay if I said a blessing." And she said, "Yes." And so I did. And I offered a blessing that basically affirmed everything that we've been speaking to tonight. And what I wanted to leave us with in closing is gratitude. Just like Steve Stuckey spoke about in a beautiful talk. Well, it comes right down to it, gratitude. Gratitude. So here we are in gratitude, reaching out, being an answer to our own prayers, creating this world together. And I think we can do it, kind of here, Norman. I think we can do it. Think we can reconcile and be reconciled and keep on loving. So let's do it. Thank you. That went a little over. I apologize. I'm sorry. But I did want to offer us a few possible questions for our breakout groups. So here they are. How have you experienced a moment of responding as waking up together to our interconnection? Or do you relate to the words God's creation as bodhisattva activity? Perhaps the activity of the bodhisattva of compassion? And is it helpful to imagine it that way, or does it get in the way? Or anything else that might be coming up for you?